Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, this week we go to India for cool ideas for eating in hot weather. Food expert Raghavan Iyer brings us new ingredients to try, delicious drink ideas, and easy, easy dishes, all inspired by the street food of his hometown, Bombay. Winemaker Randall Graham says that Riesling, the wine that's gone from nerdy to being the new buddy love, is the perfect wine for modern eating. Chef Jerry Traunfeld introduces us to the diva of the herb world, tarragon. Then it's a novel take on the tomato from where else? The French Laundry restaurant. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, do you know that Sioux City, Iowa used to be home of the largest stockyards in America?
No. I always thought it was like Chicago or Denver or something like that.
There was a time in mid-20th century when Sioux City was larger than any, and there is no stockyards anymore. However, there is a fabulous legacy of the stockyards just north of Sioux City in the town of Lamars, Iowa. It's called Archie's Wayside, and it's one of the great steakhouses anywhere.
Wayside, by the way, is spelled very oddly. It's W-A-E-S-I-D-E, because I think when they opened their doors on couple of decades ago, somebody told them there was another Wayside restaurant somewhere in Iowa. So they decided they wanted to be Wayside also, but would come up with a unique spelling. So it was kind of odd.
So this is great steak. And tell me more.
This is truly great steak. The restaurant was opened in 1949 by people who had worked in the stockyards. And to this day, they still cut and age their own beef. We went into the aging room, that frozen room, and saw the big hunks of the primal cuts, what they call, of beef. And they cut pieces of steak there, the likes of which I've never even seen in my life. The filet mignon at Archie's Wayside, normally a cut I don't pay much attention to, is one of the most delicious pieces of meat I've ever eaten. It is huge. It is tender, and most important, it is incredibly delicious with that kind of concentrated protein tang that only the most delicious aged beef has.
But Lynn, we have to give you a secret. We were told by the person who tipped us off to Archie's Wayside that when we go there, ask for the off-the-menu item called the Benny Weicker. And that is a special 18-ounce steak that is only for the cognoscenti, only for those who know enough to ask for a Benny Weicker. So if you go there, just make sure you ignore the menu.
But what cut is it?
The Benny Weicker is an 18-ounce, center-cut, 21-day, dry-aged filet mignon. It's taller than it is wide. You slice into it, and juices just run onto the plate. And the flavor is just so intense. That's what's so wonderful about it. And there are so many juices on the plate, you have to, you know, grab forkfuls of hash browns and toss them onto the plate from the hash brown plate to sort of soak up all the juices.
Now, the thing is, Archie's Wayside is a classically wonderful steakhouse. On the side, you get a great salad, you get hash brown potatoes, you get corn fritters. But the weirdest thing you get here, in addition to a relish tray when you sit down, sort of right out of the 1950s with radishes and celery sticks, is you get a plate of corned beef, which I think is such a strange thing to eat before a steak. It's on the house. Everybody gets the corned beef. It's made, it's actually corned at Archie's Wayside, and it's one of their specialties. And just be prepared to eat a lot of corned beef before you order your steak.
Is this the way they use up the whole steer?
They use everything but the moo.
So what does the place look like?
It's a classic Midwest supper club, kind of dark, spacious. A lot of cocktails are served there. It's the place people come from miles around, I mean, from hours away to eat steak here. It's a very convivial kind of oasis in the middle of Lamar's, Iowa.
This is really a, you know, kind of the big night out place. Lamar's is a very tiny little town, and Archie's, when you walk into it, has that wonderful, you know, kind of adult feeling of, you know, where you get a Manhattan or a martini, and you sit in a big, comfortable booth, and you just, you know, kind of eat as much beef and corned beef as you possibly can. It's not Chuck E. Cheese. It's not a children's restaurant, but it's very much kind of the fancy night out for people who live around Lamar's.
And I do have to say that as a lagniappe to this great steak dinner, they may or may not have dessert on the menu at Archie's Wayside. Frankly, I don't know. But Lamar's also happens to be the self-proclaimed ice cream capital of America. So you go down the street a little bit and go to the Blue Bunny ice cream soda fountain, and you can have a hot fudge sundae after your 2 pounds of beefsteak and corned beef.
Just what I'm going to want. Hey, thank you both.
What's wrong with you, Lynn? You don't know how to eat American.
I'm working
Bye,
on it.
Bye,
I'm working. Goodbye.
Eat steak, eat steak, eat a big old steer. Eat steak, do we have one beer? Eat beef, beef, beef. It's a mighty good food. It's a great day. We open our
Are we going to have emails? Well, Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is the update of their classic Road Food. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Randall Graham is an unconventional winemaker. His Bonnie Doon Vineyard in California does not produce a single Chardonnay or Cabernet. Randall doesn't believe they belong in California. Instead, he focuses on what he calls ugly duckling wines, wines producers tend to ignore. What I like is the way Randall thinks. He always has his own take on what's going on in the wine world. Randall, good to have you back.
Thank you very much.
So what's intriguing you these days?
I'm very keen on Rieslings. Riesling is a grape that's sort of misunderstood. There's a real soft spot in my heart for the ugly duckling, misunderstood, underappreciated grape varieties of the world. And Riesling is definitely one of them.
Why so misunderstood?
I think people have had either an unfortunate experience with Riesling, or somehow the word on the street is that Riesling somehow is not hip or cool. It's kind of has this old-fangled quality to it. In fact, Riesling, I think of Riesling as the nutty professor of grape varieties. It's perceived as being the nerdiest possible grape, but it is in fact the buddy love of grapes.
Now, when I think of Riesling, I think of a sweeter wine, and I may be wrong about that, but I wonder if that's the reason why a lot of people turn away from it, because supposedly we're not supposed to like sweet wines.
Right. The one thing that people know, that many consumers know, is that sweet is not good. In fact, sweet versus dry is really a specious comparison. The more interesting question is the wine balanced? And wines that are off dry, that are a little bit sweet, can actually work brilliantly with food, especially with modern fusion cuisine, Asian cuisine, which is often very sweet itself, very piquant, savory, and dry wines, especially tannic wines, oak-aged wines, don't really complement that kind of cuisine.
So the oaky Chardonnay isn't going to make it when you're having Thai, fusion, whatever.
It's the world's least food-friendly wine, I would say.
Oh, so what is a typically a Riesling you like taste like?
Well, Riesling is made in all sorts of different styles, from bone dry to off dry. What is great about Riesling is the fruitiness, the intense fruitiness, acidity, and lack of oak, and generally moderate alcohol. And all those factors tend to make it very, very nice food wine, very complementary to food, because it blends with the food rather than tries to overpower it.
Now, isn't this a grape? When I think of Riesling, I think of Germany and northern France. I don't think of a climate like California. I mean, should we be looking to those countries for Riesling?
Absolutely. The German Riesling, Austrian Riesling as well, is the apotheosis of Riesling. The Mosel in particular, I'm completely crazy about. Our Riesling comes from Washington State, which is also a very northern climate, And what we do with our Pacific Rim Riesling is we actually blend in German Riesling, about 25% German Riesling.
Ah, so it's not a California wine?
Not at all.
I see. You know, when I think, you're right, when I think about it, what are we eating these days? We're eating peppery foods and we're eating foods that have some sweetness.
You know, there's another interesting point, and that is there's kind of a dysfunction these days between wine and food. It's sort of like a dysfunctional marriage. In the land of food, in my humble opinion, maybe this is just in California, food is getting louder and louder. It's getting flashier. It wants to be noticed. So food is getting spicier. It's getting hotter. It's getting sweeter. It's getting more pungent, more savory. All of these things make the food taste very, very exciting. However, it makes it very, very difficult to pair with wine. On the wine side of it, wines are getting more extracted, higher in alcohol, higher, more oak flavor. Again, all these elements are making the wines very dramatic, but very difficult to pair with food. So it's sort of like two monologues where the two parties are not talking to each other anymore. What's interesting about Riesling is one of the few wines that are being produced these days that actually makes a liaison with food, whereas most wines are just going in the opposite direction of food.
So do you think winemakers are going to catch on to this?
Well, Tim Mondavi made a very conscious effort to produce very stylized wines under the Mondavi label that really complemented food. He was absolutely crucified for his efforts.
Why?
Because the wines weren't dramatic enough, they weren't concentrated enough, they were not following the so-called international style.
Hmm. So you're saying there's going to be a real culture lag here?
Big time culture lag.
So in the meantime, we have to drink the Rieslings.
I'm up for it. It's an assignment. Put me on that assignment. I'm there.
Okay. Randall, thank you.
My pleasure.
Randall Graham is founder of Bonnie Dune Vineyard in Santa Cruz, California. Randall's thoughts on the lack of respect given to Riesling reminds me that before balsamic thundered onto every plate in America, there was another vinegar we loved, Spanish sherry vinegar. Now, when it's aged, and the one I want to tell you about is aged a whopping 50 years, Spanish sherry vinegar can be pretty divine. It's toasty, it's rich, it always reminds me of toasted almonds over roast pork. Well, Spanish sherry vinegar isn't sweet, which means that it embellishes other flavors, but it doesn't take over. Now, if you want to invest in this 50-year-old, it's made by Jose Lobato. Now, use it sparingly. Put it over green salads, grilled foods, put it over raw sweet onions. But for something new, mix it with barely melted butter and brown sugar and pour it over apricots or nectarines or, believe it or not, over sliced tomatoes. Now, you can find aged Spanish sherry vinegars in fancy food stores and better groceries. And you can check out that 50-year-old at the Splendid Table store. It's right there on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, cooling down the Indian way with Bombay Street Food, the finicky diva of the herb garden, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. If you want to know how to keep cool in steamy weather, go to people who live in a climate with monsoons and soaring temperatures. I'm thinking of India. This is a country with phenomenally fine food and thousands of years of practice when it comes to figuring out how foods and spices help our bodies. Our guest is Indian culinary expert Raghavan Iyer. His latest book is The Turmeric Trail, Recipes and Memories from an Indian Childhood. Raghavan, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, Raghavan, you were born and raised in India. Now, where?
I was actually born and raised in Bombay, which these days is not called Bombay. It's called Mumbai. It's a name that was reclaimed after 50 years of independence from the British regime.
Now, what I want to know, because it's hot, and you come from a climate, of course, famous for its heat. How do people there cook for this kind of weather?
A lot of times the foods that we tend to do this time of the year is usually foods that are that lower your body temperature naturally. We use a lot of spices to do that. Chilies is something that tends to lower your body temperature and you really feel quite cool. I, of course, relied on the street foods of Bombay, much to the irritation of my sister and my grandmother. Those are the foods that I grew up with, and we eat a lot of fresh vegetables and fruits, especially this time of the year. It's prime mango season. I come from a country that has over 100 varieties of mangoes, and so we really eat a lot of mangoes, everything from mango desserts to mango beverages to mangoes in your main course.
So some specific dishes, for instance.
For one of the dishes that I think really typifies a wonderful use of mango and also Bombay street foods is a dish called Sev Batata Puris, which are little crispy all-purpose rounds that are topped with unripe mangoes, potatoes.
Are they like breads?
They are. They're not breads. They're more like crackers. They're about 2 inches in diameter.
Uh-huh.
And you know what puris are. They're basically deep fried.
Right.
But these are crispier versions of those. And they are quite small because they're meant to be bite-sized pieces. There are two chutneys that go on top. One is a potent ginger chilies and cilantro, and the other one is a very sweet tamarind date chutney. And it's sprinkled with crispy chickpea flour noodles. And the whole thing is popped in one bite, and so you get this wonderful flavor sensation.
But do I have to fry the little crackers and do all that?
No, actually, we are fortunate. We get a lot of these products that are already pre-made. We go to any Indian grocery store. You can buy these little Sev Puris.
So tell me what I can do with the cumin and the coriander to cool it down.
You could actually dry roast them for about 30 seconds to 45 seconds. And then as soon as they turn a shade darker, you actually can grind them or crush them with a mortar and pestle. Black salt is also a natural cooling spice.
Black salt?
Black salt. It's actually it's a mining product. It's a compound that occurs naturally from the mining industry and stone quarries. And it's got a wonderful, it almost has the smell of hard-boiled eggs.
Oh.
And a lot of times in northern dishes especially, they add a little bit of black salt to their foods. And also mango powder. Amchur, which is they take the dried pulp of unripe mangoes and grind them up, and so that's also used as a natural coolant. So is tamarind,
which has that sour, mm-hmm. lovely taste to
it. It's got such a complex flavor to it.
What about salads?
Salads, as you know, in this country is actually not existent in India because most of our salads are more accompaniments. There's a wonderful salad dish which combines fresh cucumbers and partially cooked split and hulled green lentils. And so the combination with fresh coconut and roasted mustard seed that's popped in hot oil just sends you into ecstasy.
It sounds incredible. I'm in ecstasy. I want to go back for a moment, though. You said that the street food that you loved was something that deeply disturbed your sister and your grandmother. Why?
My sister actually is a physician in Bombay, and there's a huge age difference between us. I'm saying that on national public radio here. She actually delivered me when I was born.
Oh, really?
She was doing a residency in OBGYN. And so, you know, of course, having a medic in the house, on top of that, she was my sister. She knew the best. She actually would always forbid me to go to the streets and eat, especially certain times of the year. when the chances of foodborne illnesses are much more rampant. But of course, you know, as a younger brother, you never listened to your sister, and you still did it because the temptations and the aromas that came from the street vendors' carts were just too much to pass up. And so once in a while, she was right.
And you have a whole chapter in the book about Bombay street food.
Yes, I do, because it's a kind of cooking that I really enjoyed. And you don't find that in other Indian cookbooks. And being a native of Bombay, I just thought that it's a tribute that had to happen sooner than later.
What do Indians do for beverages, especially when it's extraordinarily hot?
A lot of the beverages are usually done with fresh limes or mangoes. We, in fact, never discard the seed or the skin of the mangoes. We collect them all, and we mash them up a little bit and get all the stuff out of it, and we mix it up with water and a little bit of sugar, and we have a wonderful mango drink. We do the same thing with limes. Yogurt beverages are also quite traditional. Lassis that you're probably familiar with, having sampled them in restaurants. We do some great things with lassis that are flavored.
Now, is that just diluted yogurt?
It's actually yogurt that is diluted. I usually dilute it with a little bit of soda water. Sometimes you add a little bit of rose extract to that. Or you could do mangoes, again, with a little bit of sugar, and then you've got a wonderful cooling beverage. In southern Indian homes, which is where my roots are from, we always used to sometimes finish our meals with buttermilk that was spiked with roasted mustard seed and fresh curry leaves, which is considered a digestive and also a natural coolant, and it just works wonderful as a beverage, too. So those are some of the more traditional routes.
Interesting, interesting.
But of course, you give me a martini anytime. I'd rather go for that.
Well, Raghavan, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Raghavan Iyer is author of The Turmeric Trail, Recipes and Memories from an Indian Childhood. Now, he left us with some recipes for cooling down, including corn with roasted chilies and coconut milk. Now, I mean, can you resist that? I can't. Well, you can find them all on the website, splendidtable.org. So you've been fooling around with fresh herbs, right? Maybe sprinkling some over the takeout salad. Well, I've got somebody you really should meet. Chef Jerry Traumfeld has the herb gift. Jerry cooks at the famous Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle, and he's written the classic, The Herb Farm Cookbook. Jerry, welcome back.
Thanks, Lynn.
So what are you cooking with these days?
Oh, well, it's all kinds of herbs, but the one that I've been using a lot of recently is tarragon. And I love tarragon. Not everybody likes it. As a matter of fact, I kind of think of tarragon as kind of as the diva of the herb world. Because
diva.
If you're a big fan, you can't get enough of it. It doesn't appeal to everyone, but it's also a diva because, well, it's very refined, but it also loves to make a big presence. And it really doesn't like to share the spotlight with other herbs. So it doesn't combine that well with other herbs, but if you add it alone to a dish, it really has an amazing flavor.
So what do you like to use it with?
It goes with so many foods. First of all, with vegetables. Whenever I'm cooking vegetables like, say, just simple steamed carrots or fresh peas or asparagus, I like to just sprinkle a little bit over the vegetables right before they go to the table. And that's the thing about tarragon. It really is best if you add it at the end of the cooking process or right before you serve it. Otherwise, it'll just lose all its wonderful anisey flavor. And it's also great with chicken dishes. It's even good with beef. If you think of béarnaise sauce, the base of béarnaise is tarragon.
It's true, yeah.
And then fish and shellfish. There's almost no seafood that doesn't like tarragon. Oysters, clams, shrimp. And another simple thing I like to do is to add it to just regular old kind of sandwich salads or picnic salads, like a egg salad with a little bit of chopped tarragon, or a chicken salad, or even if you're just making a picnic potato salad, add a few tablespoons of chopped tarragon. It really adds a nice flavor.
Is there a particular kind of tarragon that we should use?
Yes, you always want to look for a French tarragon. There's another kind of tarragon called Russian tarragon. And Russian tarragon is much easier to grow. It's a much taller plant with bigger leaves, and it's very vigorous, but it doesn't have nearly the flavor of the French. It has a very inferior and subtle flavor. But the French tarragon has a really pronounced kind of punch to it when you bite into a leaf. And the French tarragon is very finicky about where it will grow. It doesn't like hot, humid summers. And even if it has the right climate, it doesn't always like its soil. So of all the herbs, it's the most finicky.
So if you live in the South, you're kind of, you're toast. Well, you can't grow tarragon.
No, there is a solution. There's another herb called, sometimes it's called Mexican mint marigold. Sometimes it's called Mexican tarragon. And this is actually a marigold, and it has little marigold-like flowers. But it loves the hot, humid weather. And it has a flavor that's very similar to the French tarragon, maybe a little bit sweeter, but you can substitute it for tarragon.
Well, that's good to know. Would you ever use dried tarragon, or am I saying something that, you know, is just beyond the pale?
Well, it's a whole different beast. Dried tarragon has a very different flavor, but it is nice. If, for instance, you can make a wonderful béarnaise sauce with dried tarragon, it just has a different flavor than the fresh.
And what about using it in sweet dishes? Because it has a sweet, as you said, sort of almost anise-y undertone to it.
Yeah, it's very good. It's actually one of the few herbs that goes well with chocolate, but I especially like it with, say, with citrus desserts. Things with grapefruit or lemon. And then I have a wonderful thing that I do with it with melon. And I make a very simple dressing with honey, lime juice, and tarragon. So I take about 2 tablespoons of freshly squeezed lime juice.
Mm-hmm.
I take a tablespoon of light-bodied honey and maybe a tablespoon or two of just roughly chopped tarragon. I mix them together. And then I just use that as a dressing for really ripe melon, or even you can use it for a like a melon salad of little melon balls. And sometimes I like to, it's nice both for dessert or as an appetizer. And if you're doing it as an appetizer, just add a little bit of a little pinch of salt and a little grinding of pepper at the end. And it's just a wonderful, refreshing late summer dish.
What a dynamite idea. I could just picture this in something like a martini glass or a wine glass. Oh, Jerry, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jerry Traunfeld is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. You can get his recipe for melon with tarragon on the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got Cindy on the line. So, Cindy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I was calling because I'm interested in learning about curing olives.
Uh-huh.
I'm living in northern Italy, and we have several olive trees on our property, and I'd like to know how I might be able to cure them.
Are you calling us from northern Italy?
No, I'm actually calling from my parents' home in St. Paul.
Okay, so you're living in northern Italy, you've got the olive trees, and you want to know how to cure the olives.
Exactly.
Well, there are several ways of doing this. You probably know that if you bite into an olive from the tree, you'll spit it out because it's so bitter.
Right.
And the substance that makes it that way, I'm trying to remember, it's something like glucoside, I think it's called.
Okay.
What you want to do is essentially leach that out of the olive. And as I remember, there's more than one way of doing this. But all of the ways take some time.
Mm-hmm.
And each one produces a slightly different taste. One way is that you take a salt brine. You take salt and water. And it's usually something like, I think it's something like 1 part salt to 3 to 4 parts water. You boil it. So you sterilize it,
mm-hmm.
and you can put flavorings in there if you want, you know, like lemon peel or garlic. But then you put the olives in that bath.
Okay.
And you change that bath every several days, but it takes 3 to 6 months.
So with that bath, then I change the bath, but there's no kind of sealing that has to be done. I just simply change the bath.
No.
Okay.
What people do is they'll put it in a deep container, something
right.
that's not going to react. It shouldn't be metal. You know,
right.
it could be anything that's non-reactive, and they'll put a plate or something on top of the olives to keep them submerged.
Okay.
So you can do it that way. You can literally toss the olives with just coarse salt, a lot of it, and any kind of flavoring you would like, and that will leach out that substance. Another very old method is that you take lye, and people used to actually use the ashes from their fireplace because that would contain lye,
mm-hmm.
mix that with water, boil it again to sterilize it, and put the olives in there, and the same thing will happen. So it's 3 to 6 months more or less. Okay?
If I use the method where I toss the olives with coarse salt,
right,
that will still take 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, it can.
How long can I keep them?
Oh, once you've done that, you can keep them for about a year.
And would I keep my capers in salt and I keep them in the refrigerator generally
right.
after they're opened?
Right, and with olives, you want to keep them in a salt brine. You
okay.
don't want to keep them in olive oil. You want to make a brine because, or something acidic, because that will kill off any harmful bacteria.
Okay.
And you can toss them with vinegar and olive oil, but more vinegar than olive oil. You can flavor them, by the way. You know, that's where, again, you can add the herbs, you can add the garlic, you can
right.
add the orange zest, the chilies, whatever you want. But, you know, there are two books to look at.
Okay.
While you're here in the United States, you may want to look for them. One is an old one. It's called, I think, the story of the olive, or the myth of the olive, the feast of the olive. That's it. It's out in paperback, came out about 10 or 15 years ago, but you'll often find it on secondhand websites.
Okay.
The other one is a relatively new book. It's a paperback. It's called Lost Arts, and it's by an author named Lynn Alley. I just got a copy of this.
Okay.
And she talks in great detail about how to cure your own olives. And she's
oh,
a real
wonderful.
Home cook. I mean, she's not doing this commercially. She tells you how to do it, you know, kind of back porch style.
Well, and so should you pick the olives off the tree or take the olives off the ground?
I'd say try to pick them off the tree before they're fully ripe.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Right.
Of course, all of us here at the Splendid Table are green with envy that this woman is living in a small village with olives on her hillside. Sounds pretty lovely. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Here's the question. What common summer fruit first came to us from a Pope's garden? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we'll be getting back to your calls in a moment. And by the way, the number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what common summer fruit comes to us from a Pope's garden? Well, it's the cantaloupe, and it probably gets its name from the place where it first gained popularity in Europe. It was the town of Cantalupo, outside Rome, where a pope had a villa. Now, I can't resist the arcane, and melons are pure gold in this department. Melons and cucumbers come from the same family, and they go way back. The ancient Egyptians and Greeks were eating them. But what I like about the melon and the cuc is that they both keep crossing the line back and forth when it comes to sweetness. I'll give you an instance. In southern Italy, there's one type of cucumber that is so sweet, it's eaten with sugar and olive oil. On the other hand, the Chinese winter melon is just like bland squash. But watermelon is my all-time favorite. Everybody has dipped into this one. Give you some more instances. In Japan, unripe watermelon is pickled in sake. In West Africa, they toast watermelon seeds along with chili and peanuts, and they grind them into a paste. And that's spread on bread and on vegetables. Russian Mennonites, they cook down watermelon pulp into a sort of a sweet syrupy jam. And last summer, in a farmer's market in Louisville, Kentucky, I had iced watermelon water. You just puree the melon, strain it, and ice it down. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Chris on the line. So, Chris, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. This is our second year of having a vegetable garden, and I've grown Thai basil. And I was hoping maybe you had some good ideas on what we can do with the Thai basil.
Oh, Thai basil is so fragrant. It smells of cinnamon and lemon. Do you get that with your Thai basil?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just imagine what that's going to taste like if you make an Italian pesto with it. Mm. I mean, don't tell the Italians you're doing that. I mean, they'll just, you know, they'll leave or whatever. But that's one way of using it. But the other thing is that it's wonderful with anything from Southeast Asia. I'll give you an instance. You can make a very simple cool broth of lemongrass and chicken broth. You know, just steep the lemongrass in hot chicken broth, and then make sure you just pull all the fat off the broth and steep the lemongrass in there, and then put it in cups and put just cold shrimp into that and sprinkle that with chopped up lemony, cinnamony Thai basil. And it's so light, and it's so cool, and it's so refreshing. And the other thing is, obviously, you've hit a nerve here, right? You know,
mm-hmm. I remember you talking about basil in the past. I knew you were the person to call.
Well, you know, if I could grow it in my bed, I'd love to sleep in it. That's what it comes down to. But there is a recipe on the website,
okay,
you know, splendidtable.org, for a melon with chili and Thai basil. It's a melon salad. See, what you do is you take chunks of cantaloupe, you sprinkle them with salt and black pepper, you chop up the Thai basil, you chop up a nice hot red chili, and you toss that together and you sprinkle it with rice vinegar.
Oh, that sounds great.
Doesn't that sound great?
Yes.
And by the way, the other thing you can do with any green herb is whatever's left, freeze. Okay?
Okay.
That's it.
Great.
Well, I wish I were growing Thai basil right now. Hey, Chris, thanks for a great question.
Thanks for your help.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, this idea of growing basils, first of all, do you know that I think there is something like 15 different kinds of basil? So you could dig up your entire front lawn and just do nothing but a basil patch. Think about spicy globe basil, which you will probably find in your farmer's market. They're little teeny tiny leaves. And in southern Italy, like in Sicily, they make a pesto with them. They throw in almonds and a ton of garlic and a little olive oil and this kind of spicy. It tastes a little bit like nutmeg, cinnamon, and black pepper. You can reach us and call us and talk to us at 800-537-5252. All right, we've got Cyrus on the line. Cyrus.
Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm good. What do you want to talk about?
I've got a question about something popular here in North Carolina, which is a sweet potato.
Oh, boy, yeah. Yeah, okay.
The question is, I tried making a dessert out of them. I tried making a sweet potato mandarin orange crisp.
That sounds great.
It came out okay, but I was curious if you had any ideas for other uses. And desserts especially.
Desserts for sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I've got one.
Okay.
I've not done this, but I think it has to work.
I'll give it a shot.
All right. Take sort of sticks of the sweet potato, but not cut too thick.
Okay.
And dip them in honey. Right. And grill them on the grill.
That sounds good.
They're crusty on the outside and beginning to soften on the inside. And then I'd serve them topped with something like whipped cream or sour cream.
Okay.
I think that would be just swell. Because sweet potatoes have that crusty caramelization that they get
right.
when you brown them. And if you do them on the grill, I mean, they've got to be just super.
One thing I used to do is microwave them for 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe not that long.
Right.
And, cut them in half.
Uh-huh.
And then cut slits in them.
Yeah.
And put brown sugar on top and sit them on the grill when you're cooking something else.
I could eat that. I hate to say it, but you know what I'd want to put in those slits, too?
Butter.
No? Well, butter,
too. Butter in there and then brown sugar on top.
Nah, how about Shades of Thanksgiving? Put marshmallows in there.
Yep, that's a good idea, too.
I'm thinking of the wonderfully goofy things you can do with a grill and a sweet potato.
Yep.
Another great idea?
Okay.
Microwave them the way you said so that they're soft, though, maybe a little longer.
Right.
And then puree them with an egg and brown sugar. And a little rum, a pinch of hot chili, and some cinnamon, and then bake them in a water bath and make little sweet potato custards. And you could serve that with I'm big on whipped cream today. You could serve with some whipped cream or some sour cream, just a little daub, and serve them cold.
Okay.
Think whatever you can do with a pumpkin, you can do with a sweet potato, and it's going to taste a lot better. Pumpkins are generally pretty blah, whereas sweet potatoes are just killer.
Potatoes are good.
Sweet potatoes are really good. You know, another great idea. How about paper-thin slices and deep fry them and make sweet potato chips?
Not bad.
That's not a bad thing.
Sounds
and
good.
Roll that in chili and orange zest. Lime zest.
The orange does work well with it. I tried the mandarin oranges, and they go pretty well with it.
Yeah, that would be good, too. And you could use some fresh oranges or do a sweet potato. Oh, I've got it. How about a summer cobbler? Not a cobbler, it's summer gratin. Thin slices of sweet potato.
Yeah.
Okay, daub them with butter and cinnamon and black pepper, all right?
Okay.
And then on top of that, slices of peaches, and then slices of potatoes and slices of peaches and lots of butter, and you bake it very slowly in the oven.
Wow.
Like 325 for an hour and a half, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's going to taste good.
Okay, good experiment.
All right. Vanilla
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Vanilla ice cream on that.
Okay, I'll do it. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Hey, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. I've got to tell you about something I just came across in the New York Times. There was a bit in the food section about this very upscale Italian restaurant in New York City called Harry Cipriani's. Now, they had on their menu something they called an environmental advisory, and it said, I quote this, "The use of cellular phones interferes with the preparation of risotto." Well, we called the restaurant to find out what this was all about, and they told us that it had just been taken off the menu, but they explained to us where it came from. Now, the original Cipriani's is the famous Harry's Bar in Venice. And in 1990, the owner there in Venice got so disgusted with the fact that Italians use their cell phones nonstop 24 hours a day, and they're constantly on them. He decided to put this notice on the menu. Now, no one can figure out what risotto has to do with the cell phones, but they've just taken it off the menu. We'll keep puzzling over the risotto connection. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up? We've got Linda calling. Linda, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Is there some pressing issue?
Oh, most definitely. It's one of barbecue sauce.
Oh, this is important.
Yes. My husband has been working on developing his customized barbecue sauce.
I see.
It's a tomato-based sauce with all the typical things you might expect, mustard, cayenne pepper, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he has refined the taste to where it's just perfect. However, the texture is a little off, and it's somewhat like the ingredients separate a little. And we're not really looking for a thick, necessarily, barbecue sauce. It has body.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were wondering, is there something that we could use as an emulsifier to allow us to achieve that kind of silky, velvety texture?
Right now, I want to smear it on my fingers and lick it off. You've got...
Oh, it's delicious.
I don't know. I think when you have, I think you guys are being perfectionists, and I want you to just pull back a little and relax.
Ah.
No, no, because if you have got something that you think is right there, that you've really nailed it, if you start putting other stuff into it, I mean, when you buy a commercial barbecue sauce in a jar, mm-hmm. read the label. Look at all the stuff that I think of, not as real food, but as junk that's in there. And a lot of it's just to get a consistency that people associate with barbecue sauce. If it
And that's what we've done. And we thought, oh, yuck. I mean, is there something that would contribute in a positive way?
Well, you know, an emulsifier might be something like, you know, a starch of some kind, like flour or more tomatoes that you boil in or a fat.
Yeah.
But I think that's all going to throw off how the sauce tastes.
Yeah, we've got the recipe.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, do you brush this on food and then cook it? Is that how you use it, or do you have it at the table sitting in a jar, in a bowl?
Both.
Because I was going to say, once it's on the food, nobody is going to know.
Yeah. that's true.
Yeah, I would just enjoy the fact you've really nailed something that you both love. You can beat it up if you want to.
Correct. Well, okay.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's actually very encouraging because we talked about, you know, the taste is perfect. And it's taken a lot of trials and testing to get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want to spoil that because that's ultimately what we're after.
That's exactly right.
And all the rest of this is fluff, I guess.
In this case, yeah. When you've got something you're that pleased with and you've worked that long on.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time to talk tomatoes. Again, it's my favorite food right now. And we've discovered a new way to use tomatoes. It came from the professional help column that appeared in the LA Times. It was written by French laundry chef Thomas Keller and Michael Ruhlman, who is the author of The Soul of a Chef. Now, their new way with tomatoes is called tomato water, and Michael Ruhlman is here to tell us about it. Michael, it's good to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here, as always, Lynn.
Are you in the kitchen right now, by any chance?
No, I can see it, but I'm at my desk right now.
Well, why don't you tell us what tomato water is?
Tomato water is the liquid from tomatoes, and that's all it is. What that liquid is an almost clear, or you can get it virtually a clear fluid that has this very powerful flavor of tomato. It's got a sort of an acidic and sweet tomato flavor, and it is gotten from the tomatoes just by pureeing the tomatoes and letting the water drip out of them, and that's all there is to it.
So you put them in something to let them drip, like in a strainer?
You put them in a strainer. The best way to do it is to put it in, wrap it in some cheesecloth and set it in the strainer over a bowl and let it sit overnight in the refrigerator. What you will be left with is sort of a yellow-tinted, sort of a little bit viscous liquid.
Uh-huh.
And it's powerfully flavored, and you can do all kinds of stuff with it. And it's a great thing to do in the summer when you've got tons of fresh tomatoes.
So tell us what you do with tomato water.
The uses are many. You can serve it just as it is, as a cold soup.
Mm-hmm.
It's thrilling. Putting some garnish in it with something spicy like a jalapeno pepper works well, or some thyme, some fresh little thyme leaves.
Mm-hmm.
It would make a beautiful little canapé soup. You can gel it and make what is essentially tomato aspic, which people sort of fear now because they're used to, or those who know it coming out of a can as sort of like tomato jello. But it makes a lovely aspic. You can cook in it. You can poach in it. You can use it as a sauce. It's a powerfully flavored liquid, and you can do with that so many things.
Now, how long does it keep?
That's up to the taste of the cook. It can keep. It's not going to hurt you,
mm-hmm.
but it will start to lose its flavor. It will taste a little off. It'll start picking up the flavors of the refrigerator. So you'd want to use it within a week, really, for its best potential.
Can you freeze it?
You can freeze it. Freeze is great. In fact, here's a great way to use using it. Thomas Keller, famed for his imagination, and deservedly so, froze tomato water, got an Italian ice maker, and made an Italian ice.
Oh, wow.
Covered it with gazpacho garnish, red onion and other gazpacho garnish, and made a gazpacho snow cone.
Oh, this sounds incredible. And you could do that by pouring the tomato water in a shallow plastic container. I'm just thinking now.
Uh-huh.
And as it's starting to freeze, every hour or so, you go in and you stir it with a spoon. And that's how you make a granita if you don't have the machine.
Absolutely.
It makes this ragged ice. Holy cow, because I'm imagining how intense it has to be.
It is. You can even make it more intense. You can cook it down a little bit. Very, very gently cook it down. And intensify that flavor. You can clarify it further. It's hard to get it perfectly clear, because there's still very, very fine pieces of pulp in there.
But what could be bad about fine pieces of pulp?
Nothing. But what's so cool about tomato water is that you could serve it in a martini glass with, say, a grilled shrimp on the edge and some jalapeno, diced jalapeno, for a shrimp cocktail, another Keller idea. This was a signature thing that he opened the French Laundry with. But because it's clear, you don't expect it to have flavor. You expect it to be very mild. But then when you taste it, it's very, very strong and powerful. It's a surprise. It's very exciting to eat.
It sounds like a tomato nectar. Michael, thank you.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Lynn, as always.
Michael Ruhlman and Thomas Keller co-authored the award-winning French Laundry Cookbook. Well, that's a wrap for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought. If you must choose between two evils, pick the one you've never tried before. All the information you will ever need is up on our website, splendidtable.org. And believe me, if it's not there, you probably don't need it. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, drop us a line at the Splendid Table Forum and take a look at the Splendid Table store. All the proceeds go to support the show. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Musical inspiration, once again, from Rob Hibzinski. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.